Hi, I'm Tina Govan. I'm an architect placemaker based out of Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'd like to invite you to join Mustafa Sharif and myself as we discuss child-friendly cities, how we can design buildings more as places than as separate objects, and ways to celebrate the local life of a place and enable its bottom-up expression. Hope you can join us for this fun conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. Today we have a new episode and we have an amazing storyteller. I have the pleasure to welcome you, Tina, to Urbanistica podcast. Hey, and welcome.
Thank you, Mustafa. Glad to be here.
So how are you?
Doing well. Trying to stay cool. It's very hot here. I'm in North Carolina.
Wow. So are you going outside or no?
Generally, I try to avoid outside these days. It's like over 100. You know, it's really, really, really hot.
But how is it inside? You have air condition and...
Yes.
Nice. And how is it in general? Did you have your summer vacation or...
We are actually planning one for September. So that's coming up. So looking forward to that.
Yeah. But is it like this in the US or it's like a kind of late summer vacation?
Just that we've shifted our vacation schedule because our kids have grown up. So now we can go when it's cooler. I think in August, we just sort of hunker down because the outside becomes uninhabitable. Yeah.
How old are your kids now, by the way?
So my kids are now 24 and 27.
What?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. So they're little boys in a creek video that I made.
And, yeah, like in the documentation, I thought like they still, you know.
I know. No, their time flies.
Yeah, true. But they are still in the same state or they change?
Please. They've changed. So one is in New Orleans working with a nonprofit to do habitat restoration. And the other one is just graduated from UNCA in music.
Nice. So Tina, let's start with you. You are our storyteller. How would you like to introduce yourself and tell us about your passion?
So I'm an architect placemaker, I would say urban lover and community instigator and activist. That's how I'd describe myself, I think.
Yeah. And this is like the professional or the formal way of...
The formal way. And then I'm a mother, of course, which and on those two things, you know, kind of being an architect and a mother have informed me in my life in a big way.
Yeah. And take me back in time, like where you grew up, how was your childhood?
I grew up in different parts of the country. My father was a university librarian, so I moved around quite a bit. Not too much, but, you know, from university town to university town and born in Alabama. My family's from the Southeast and, you know, came to settle here when I was in, this is North Carolina, when I was about 14 and then went to school here. When I really wanted to travel and so I joined the Peace Corps when I got out of college and went and worked in Africa, built my first building there out of mud.
Nice. Wow.
And taught architecture students there, believe it or not. And this is Plibo, Liberia. And then after that came back, worked for an office here. And then went on to grad school at MIT,
met some Japanese architects in grad school who taught me, and they invited me to come work for them in Japan. So I worked there for 2 years. That was a big influence on me. And then came back to Raleigh to start my own office.
Yeah. And what made you start studying architecture?
I really loved making things and sort of influencing my environment, and I seemed to be good at math, and I was really trying to figure it out. There was a great design school nearby, and I thought I'd try it, and I really loved it. So I was trying to, you're always trying to figure out how to sort of match your energy and your passions with how to make money. How do you fit into society? And an architect seemed to be the closest thing at that time.
Yeah, like gathering all these aspects.
Exactly. Though, I think in retrospect, I could have easily become a landscape architect or a urban planner like yourself. I mean, I love all those issues.
Yeah, but I think like back in time, architecture was like the main, the coolest profession. There was not so much like urban planning or landscape, right? They were not so cool like now, today, right? Or what do you think?
I guess so. Yeah, I think you're right. I think urban planner and landscape design have definitely gotten cooler compared to architects.
Yeah, I think so. Like in the same, like in my country, we are always talking about being an architect, but not so much about urban planner or landscape or urban designer. But in the recent years, we start like these two professions growing up, and
the roles you choose as a young person, are sort of whatever is on the menu at the moment. Sometimes you don't always see the alternative paths. But looking back, I'll say a little bit later, is like as my career developed, I really got more conscious of these broader issues. And I got a little frustrated at the sort of role I was playing as an architect, because I discovered that I loved the idea of cities and bigger issues of society and the built environment. And you don't always get to address those as an architect.
But you become more interested in traveling the cities when you got your first baby?
Yes.
Or how is it?
Yes. So, I think when you become a parent, it really changes how you see the world. In fact, some of the most sort of like passionate placemakers I found in my neighborhood are parents, because they're natural placemakers. They care about the environment, because they have stake in it, because it really, they've got children. And so suddenly it broadens all the things you care about, and you start seeing how things affect your child. So that's what happened. Yeah. My kids were having a hard time finding a place to play. Everything was private. They were being run off. I've said, they were like refugees in their own town. There were no leftover places. And I could see that I was getting frustrated. This was maybe 15 years ago, so things have gotten a little bit better. But generally, when you had kids, you moved to the suburbs, and we were downtown, and you drove your kids everywhere. And a lot of my neighbors were driving their kids, to soccer and all of that stuff that we all know. So that they didn't have mobility. We had pretty much no bike lanes, a lot of places without sidewalks. So they couldn't get around on their own. In their elementary school was rather restrictive. You weren't allowed to like sometimes run on the playground. Really ridiculous things.
Yeah.
And so it seemed like this denial of play. And so that really got me thinking about it. And also our downtown which is very close by, was really just for 30 somethings for eating and drinking. And so watching people drink beer and eat hamburgers is not that interesting. And so there was no diversity. And then we would go to other countries, we would see all kinds of diversity downtown, like in a Greek plaza. Or I've told that story of like going out to dinner in Turkey and having kids play soccer right next to our table. Our kids going out and joining them and connecting with them, and then seeing them at the market the next day. So, but all of that kind of family going out together, where you have old and young together and you have kids playing downtown right up against people eating and drinking, just felt so like so much life. And in America and in a lot of towns here, they segregate so much. So if you want to go play, you get driven out to the rec center on the outskirts of town. And also, you know, that's where families move to when you have kids. And instead of having more activities downtown, more things for families downtown. And, you know, when you were asking about, you know, and you ask about passion sometimes, what's your passion? And I think I've started to think about myself in terms of my son's job. You know, he does habitat restoration, and I see what I do is just another form of habitat restoration. You know, because if you want the wildlife of children, you have to make that a habitat for them. And if you want families downtown, you'd have to have a habitat for them.
Yeah, so your way of thinking about cities and architecture changed after you got after you got children.
Right, very much.
So how you start to think?
Well, I just started to think from the kids' point of view, and how they were really didn't have the freedom that I wanted them to have to explore. And I didn't want just the option of enrolling them in, you know, soccer leagues and driving them around. You know, I wanted them to be able to explore on their own and be unsupervised. And I felt like the city should be for them as well. And I didn't see that happening. They didn't, all these things were missing, like places to play and how to move around. It sort of activated the sort of inner activists in me.
Yeah, because like this is what I want to ask, like how you start, like what kind of action you start to take.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I started documenting my kids playing. You know, they discovered this creek across from elementary school, and that they did find this one place that was sort of wild where they could make their own world and play in a way that they would like. They didn't really like me documenting it. You know, they would hide and run in the bushes, and I would come with my camera. But it really changed their life, this creek. They would throw their backpacks over their shoulders, take off their shoes, run down to the water and play. They built forts, they built rafts, you know, they collected ceramics and glass from the creek, used it as money, had little shops where they'd sell things to each other. They even printed up creek money. I mean, they really made a whole society. And I thought it was fascinating. I thought, well, okay, some magic is happening here. So I wanted to document it as a way of sort of presenting a model to the city and to other parents. You know, to say this is something special. So this is something we should reinforce. And you know, as time went on, it evolved, and the story of these kids really became more and more compelling because they started exploring the city in that same way, sort of had a lot of confidence in themselves, tested themselves, and all grew up to be stewards of their environment, you know, landscape architects and stuff, and urban ecologists and habitat restorers and that kind of thing. So it really affected how they developed as adults. And so I got on the sort of route of trying to empower children, and I made a little movie about it that I shared and presented at conferences. I got these kids when they were a little bit older to come downtown and help me make a presentation about this idea, and had a panel discussion and talked about growing up in the city. Tried to sort of foster some activism in them. I would bring them downtown to advocate for skate parks and things like that, you know, to have your voice. And you know, and since then I've run some campaigns, like, you know, kid mayor campaign, what would listening to kids, what they would like if they were mayor of the city. So those are some of the steps, you know, just sort of inviting them to conferences and talk, and actually having them speak for themselves and present this as a model, and not only for cities to trust kids more, but also for parents, because there's so many parents that kind of keep their kids under lock and key and don't trust the outside, and their worlds have shrunk. And so say, hey, look at the benefit of letting kids explore and have this wildness, this sort of free range kid idea, and spread that word. I mean, there is actually a very cool organization here called Natural Learning Initiative, run by Robin Moore at NC State. And they have a conference every year called Growing in Place. And I've been going to that religiously. So that also kind of fueled my fire. Yeah. I mean, and Tim Gill talks about this a lot, if you've talked to him, or And so just the that freedom of childhood and exploring, I saw it dwindling away as we all became more and more isolated.
Yeah. And like back in time when you were presenting these ideas, I know now we are like accepting this chat from the cities and we're talking about it. There are books and so on. But back in time, when you start to talk, okay, children, we give them freedom, give them space of the city, invite them to conferences. How was the reaction of like cities or authorities?
You know, they listened, but you know, it's how whether you get real action is another question. You know, I think you start conversations, you get kids to be vocal themselves. You know, you speak up, but it takes a while for things to sink in with the city and the parents. You know, people are always kind of looking at what other people are doing before they take a step. So it's better. It's better now, totally. And like in Raleigh, it is. I mean, the attitudes are shifting. There were a lot of, you know, no signs in Raleigh, and there still are quite a bit of like no skateboarding, no rollerblading, and all of that. Teenagers seem to be especially threatening to cities and the people, you know. So some of that still exists, but now downtown we have a splash fountain finally where kids can play in that, and I'm hoping for it to grow. So, you know, it's slow going, like everything.
Yeah, yeah. But like many of the listeners, I guess they are parents as well.
Right.
Like, what is your advice to adults who has children to not to lock them down them in the box? Like, how can we think and help children to be free and explore the city and learn?
I think you have to just loosen up. I mean, I think you have to trust your kids. And I know that when they're young, you know, you take baby steps. Like right now I'm trying to implement some play streets. So just the idea that you let kids go out in the street and play with each other is a first step. And, you know, there's a great map. I don't know if you've seen it, that Tim Gill shows of how the range of kids, how far they can wander, you know, a century ago versus today, and it's progressively shrunk. So I think if you can you just have to basically trust them and not have to not protect them from everything. So I mean, there's degrees. Of course you have to feel safe to some extent, but you can't sort of design their life for them. They have to discover it for themselves. And I think it's kind of an attitude shift. But I also think that if the city provides infrastructure, you know, like protected bike lanes or bike paths that are away from traffic, that makes parents feel better. And if they have access to playgrounds or areas to play in, on their own, that makes a big difference. So if they can get there, I think mobility, you know, safe mobility for children is really key. The non-car mobility.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, so there's a series on Netflix, I think, called Old Enough. you know, it's Japanese, and they talk about how they send little four-year-olds out to go shopping. So I think that, you know, we could get there. I mean, the Japanese have a much sort of more trust of each other, but still, I think if there's public transportation or bike lanes, that also helps. And there's places to go, and you take it step by step, and then you see that they enjoy it. They come back with confidence.
Exactly. And like from that time, like you did the documentary, and do you start like to focus more on child-friendly cities project, or no, you kept doing your architecture projects and a child-friendly city became a kind of side project?
I was ongoing with the child-friendly cities. I mean, because and even today, you know, I'm trying to sort of spread the Playing Out network, which started in the UK, to try to get play streets going. I guess what, you know, like I said earlier, what happened was I had an architecture practice that was public and private work. But I had the urge more and more to do more public realm work and something that affected my community, because I think, you know, as an architect, you end up often serving the people who can afford you. And you might make a beautiful place for them. It might be out in the woods and you don't get to see it unless they invite you for dinner. But if you go out your front door, it's not, and sometimes not so nice, you know, it's like the cityscape. So wanting to have a broader impact in those places was important to me. And I started to do a lot of kind of side projects and taking on some public work that addressed that. But, you know, I introduced a initiative with the American Institute of Architects for an Activate fund, along with some other people, which is about sort of strengthening the civic role of the architect and trying to get them more involved with the community. You propose projects and they get funded to do something that is more community engaged. So I've always been kind of pushing towards that, but a lot of the work has been kind of pro bono side projects, you know, starting a farmer's market. So it wasn't all child friendly, but you know, I feel like what Tim Gill says is true, that when you design for children, when you think about children, it's really for everybody. You know, what Gil Penalosa says about the 880 cities, you know, you're when you design for children, you're also designing for people who are older, and it becomes a more inclusive city. So things like the pop-up farmers market in a parking lot, and, you know, helping my local business district get public benches and murals and that kind of thing were all part of my work as well.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about, like, some project that you did with focus on child friendly cities, like the campaign you told me now about the mayor, what do you call it?
Oh, Kid Mayor.
Yeah, Kid Mayor.
That and that was sort of in conjunction with Placemaking US. That was involving the schools and getting them to trying to motivate kids to submit their own movies with their cell phones, saying what would they do if they were mayor, and so thinking about civic issues and what they liked or didn't like in their environment. And that was really interesting. It was across a whole range of schools, and then I compiled that into sort of a short movie and shared that out. And I did it here in Raleigh, and then Madeline Spencer did it in Santa Ana. And we kind of compared the two responses. Yeah. So I think, you know, that was really motivating. One teacher here is talking about starting a youth council that would advise the city council here in Raleigh so that they can get children's perspectives on what's not working and what is working. So that was one initiative. Let's see, other child-friendly stuff has been and I've tried to, I've worked some projects in some sort of paying work, like helping do a Montessori school here nearby. And then recently did an after school program for children who are disadvantaged and in the foster care system. And they were sort of inside just an auto showroom, having their classes there and really transformed where they go to school and made it more into a place. You know, this idea of architecture becoming a place instead of an object.
Yeah.
So that's been exciting.
Yeah, like how can we do that? Like how can architects think more in terms of like making places instead of objects?
Well, this has been another big focus of my energy. I think there's several ways. You know, one is seeing outdoor rooms the same as indoor rooms. You know, so that the spaces between buildings are just as important as the spaces within buildings, and that really we're just weaving a fabric. We're going from inside to outside, and giving attention to how you shape those outdoor spaces. So this idea of the school where these kids were housed, they would just pop out of this auto showroom onto this asphalt parking lot, and there was no place to play. I mean, they were just looking for enclosure, just sort of like splashing around in puddles and trying to find a place against the chain link fence. And so we added an enclosure. We added classrooms that enclosed an outdoor courtyard with a porch that wrapped around the whole thing. So it became sort of an outdoor living room for them. And we dug up the asphalt parking lot and made it all green. So it really transformed the space and made it into a place. So I think anytime you can enclose a space or pay attention to that space between, that's a way of making it more of a place than an object. It makes a sort of a series of insides. In fact, you can see sort of the whole built environment as nested insides, you know, the inside, inside a courtyard, inside a street, inside a city. It's all kind of layers of insides. And another is like the idea of boundaries, you know, having more porous boundaries, softer edges. I think that's really important. You know, when you have hard edges that separate inside and out, then it becomes more object-like. You know, it's not merging with the surroundings. You know, when I spent time in Japan, they're like experts at that, kind of giving these options between inside and outside and the merging of in and out. And I think that's really metaphorical for all kinds of things. You know, the relationship between inside and out. If you have a soft edge or a hard edge, what kind of exchange you have between those two things is really critical. You know, I mean, it's almost like, you know, would you have a river in a concrete channel versus a wide bank where it can spread out and have more room and more life happens. So those edges where you make them deep, you know, like a porch, then there's more continuity between the life inside and the life outside. And you allow that life in. And I actually think the porch is a great metaphor for this. I've looked a lot at the idea of the porch, because it's where you see the inside life appear. And in where I am, there's porches up and down the streets, and the variety of life you see in those and the different ways they're inhabited are really amazing. And it's like this handshaking zone between the people who walk down the street and the people in the house. And we need more of those thresholds. You know, and I think as urban designers and as architects, we spend a lot of our energy designing those kinds of spaces, the nature of those boundaries, threshold between inside and out, and it to connect with place in the life around you. I think it's really critical to make those soft, porous boundaries, and the idea of not finishing everything. You know, I think one reason the porch is so lively is because it's unfinished.
Yeah, it's not programmed 100%.
Yeah, or just partially built. So I think if architects could partially build, and there's a Dutch architect named John Hebrocken who talked about this idea of structure infill, where you just like, he was at my sort of my mentor in grad school, but he would talk about how you have to see the environment as layers, soft to hard, permanent to temporary. And so if you don't finish everything and you let other more dynamic sort of forces inhabit your building, like people or nature, Then there's more of an exchange, and then it changes and you're more connected to place, you know, versus just no exchange at all, or a sheer wall, or, you know, it really gets sort of taken over by the life of a place, sort of like, you know, vernacular villages, you know, where it grows in place over time, makes it more connected to where this is happening, where you live. And so I think that's a hard lesson, but for people to think about, you know, like, I'm not going to decide everything, you know, like Frank Lloyd Wright, where he decided everything, designed all the furniture, designed the people that would live there. So I think that's another way to connect with place. And and one other way is to basically take notice of what's in a place first. You know, I mean, like, notice the patterns that are there, you know, the on the street, or what's existing, and how can you sing the same tune as that? How can you continue what's already there in some way, instead of being weird or trying to get attention in some way? But, you know, if you could try to link arms with whatever's in a place, and then you build strength, and you can connect better. But I think we've gotten sort of into a pattern of trying to distinguish ourselves too much, and I think in the U.S. especially, there's a lot of emphasis on just sort of private property, and it's an issue.
I mean, why it's become like this?
In
it's a question
the
of economy, yeah.
I think. Well, I know that architecture has sort of fostered a culture of look at me and award winning, and what they reward can be sort of things that get attention. And oh, look, there's a modern building, you know, sort of, or look, so-and-so did that, you know, and there's also just sort of emphasis on being creative and innovative. And so I think people try to prove that they are creative. And so to do that, they have to, you know, push back or do something different from what's already there. And I think that's an unfortunate attitude. You know, I mean, I think you still do something innovative and creative, but if you can do it in a way that it reinforces what's there as well, or picks up on patterns in a place where you're a good neighbor and you try to build something along a street, you know, let's do something together, versus no, I'm different, look at me. And then you end up with a bunch of buildings that are all saying that, and it's incoherent, and they won't cooperate. And then I think we also have an issue with shared space. I think that everyone's so sort of focused on, not everyone, but, you know, sort of the cultures of a private property and not trusting sharing space and public space. And I'm hoping that's going to shift, that's going to change. But right now it seems to be continuing. But that's our history in the U.S.
Yeah. And like, now what you told us is about like how to turn, like to think about like making a place instead of an object. But what if we go one level up and thinking to make these places child-friendly places, like what should we think about?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, well, places like Copenhagen have it. You know, have done it well. I think if you can make shared spaces that are safe, you know, for kids to come out in their immediate environment and then graduate, you know, then go further and further and further. So, you know, again, it's about these soft boundaries and thresholds. So if you can, sometimes here you can see there's a new kind of movement called Pocket Neighborhoods by Ross Chapin is sort of pushing that here, where the houses face a common yard, and that's where the kids come out and play. So I think there is this idea of safety. And so having some sort of eyes on the street, place where kids can come out and play, and even in between that, adding a porch or that in-between zone. So these sort of baby steps into the outside world. And each one of these kind of represents an attitude towards the outside world, how open you are, how adventurous, and how you develop over time. So once you leave maybe that courtyard, then, you know, it has to feed into this other infrastructure, which is like protected bike lanes or walkways where kids can move around on their own. And then there's a park nearby, you know, and then it graduates to, you know, even bigger and bigger spaces and farther and farther away as they start exercising their muscles. So I think providing all those stepping stones is really important. You know, I've said in some of my presentations that my kids didn't have that so much. And so, you know, they were going into abandoned buildings and skateboarding and parking decks and being chased by the police. So, you know, when you don't have, but there's that energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can tap that energy and use it to help shape your cities. And again, it's not only for kids, you know, it's also for elderly or people who can't afford a car or who don't have a car. It's this kind of soft city that you're making that like David Sim writes about in his book. And there's all kinds of other ways I think kids should be celebrated in downtown. My son plays guitar and he busked downtown, and I once got him performing in the middle of the street. And he never forgot it. You know, it's like, you know, it makes such a difference to them at that age. And it also teaches them that the city is theirs and that they can have an impact that gives them agency. You know, they aren't ignored, and when you bring kids out to perform like that, you not only get them, but you get their friends, and then you get those friends' parents, and you get it all ripples out in the grandparents. I mean, they're a real community builder and everyone comes. So I think there's so much, it's such a beautiful age, you know, when you're young, and it can have such an impact on the city and on them, and that we don't tap into that energy enough. So I feel like performance is one area that should really be exploited.
And Tina, you mentioned now is this like the transition from being at home to the outside.
Yes.
Do you believe that like the city should have this gradually child-friendly spaces, or the entire city should be child-friendly?
I think it'd be great if the entire city was, I think, you know, I mean, you definitely have to have streets where, you know, I guess trucks are and things like that. But I think if as much child friendliness as you can incorporate, the better. I believe also that you should encounter children just on the street. You know, they should be out in the public realm. They should be visible. Too often, you know, they're segregated because of fears, you know, fears that of their safety. And so they're in some fenced playground that's separated. And so this idea of sort of integrating playful spaces throughout the city, I think is really important. You know, I was really struck when I was in Copenhagen. It's always everyone's model, Copenhagen, right?
Yeah.
But you hear children laughing all the time around every corner. It's so nice. And to hear children, to see children, to have them playing, it's a relief to us, you know, to see that. So I think the more that you can integrate it into the streetscape, the better. It's a diverse life. There's a little shop I designed around the corner from me that has babies, beer, and dogs all the time, and kids. So you have it's the same idea of like in Greece, and you go out there and you can have a beer, and then the kids are out down there drawing with chalk on the sidewalk, and to see that life on the street, those play spaces for kids integrated, I think, yeah, totally makes for a diverse city, and that we should integrate Other things that kids like to do, like skateboarding and basketball and sports.
You know? Because like we know how important is it to like to make a city child friendly and why and so on. There's so many books, so many scientific researches, but now it's more about like the how. How do we do that?
Right. And so I think really critically, number one is bike lanes. I think safe bike infrastructure is super critical. And walking, you know, of course, that might be just obvious, but we still haven't done it here much. And leaving space. I mean, I think that a problem that we have here is that we build everywhere. So because everything's a matter of money, profit, capitalism is our religion here in the US. And so it's just having the courage to leave space for play and for kids to act, animate, I think is really needed. And that might take, some city leaders who are going to not just sell everything to developers. I think it takes some parents and pushback from the bottom up. You know, if you can get parents who are really advocates for their kids to do that. Making kids more visible in the public realm, you know, making programs where rather than booking bands from out of town maybe to come perform, but you actually tap the public schools and bring them down to perform. That you loosen up rules for busking, that you you purposefully, intentionally, you know, integrate some of these things that kids like to do, like skateboarding. You know, instead of saying no, you know, no skateboarding, let's embrace it, you know, let's like celebrate it, let's like, because I think the energy of downtown and neighborhoods too becomes dead when it's so controlled and you're so exclusive and you say no, this is just for eating and drinking, or this is just for adults, you know. So if you can allow it and celebrate it, you know, I often use this example of the Fourth Street Cage, West Fourth Street Cage in New York, where the kind of people that come to watch that, you know, when kids are out there playing, or adults, like older people like to come watch it because they can't do that anymore, or it just brings all kinds of crowds. It's like a performance. It's like a dance performance almost. So I think in skateboarding as well, there's leftover spaces that could be given over to skateboarding. And so I think if we can embrace some of these things that kids enjoy and incorporate them into the downtown and into our neighborhoods, then it's a win-win, you know. I mean, and people will be drawn out. People will be attracted to it. It will animate our streets, and it will also give such pride to the kids, and they would feel like the city belongs to them too, that they have a place to go. And then they go there and they want to go show off. You know, it's like a stage. And, you know, so I think it's just healthy. And I think parents so appreciate that too. I mean, parents have to like hire babysitters, and, you know, in the same way that they kind of have to have their older parents, you know, the older people taken care of somewhere, the same issues are with their kids. And so the more that they can bring them along, you know, I know moms that look for places where there's a kids' corner, or they go to have coffee, or like I was saying, you go to have a beer and have a place for their kids to play with each other. That's a relief for them. You know, they don't have to make a date with a babysitter, pay money. You know, it's all this kind of chopping up of life that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we got to be just welcome all of it and not be so protective and afraid.
Because usually we design to a specific target group, like, let's say if we design a place and so on, we think, okay, this place is for adults, from this age to this age. And usually it's about consuming money, you know, like consuming and paying money. But now, like, what I hear from you is more about like thinking about the others as well. Like, how do we design a place that children also could be part of it somehow by some activities?
Right, right. I mean, I think like, you know, as I've moved more and more towards placemaking, a realization that's really clear to me is the fact that there's so much life in a city. And we can either nurture it and celebrate it or squash it and segregate it. And I think cities really could benefit from celebrating the life, tapping the life. You know, kids have so much to offer. They're full of life. And so I think if we can make space for that and honor them and bring it out, I would love to walk downtown and see kids doing skateboarding tricks or playing basketball. I can't do either one of those. I mean, I love just walking downtown and seeing kids, you know, naked in a fountain. It's relaxing, you know. Otherwise, it's there's someone eating a pizza. It's like we need more diversity. And that's what I did love about Greece is like, you know, sometimes a soccer ball would go over my head while I'm eating, but I love that. You know, it's lively.
Yeah. It's livable. So like, tell me about your story with the placemaking. When and how did it start? And because like now, I love also that you tell us more about your placemaking project in Raleigh.
Right. Well, so, as I was saying, you know, this kind of energy was building up inside of me that I wanted to move beyond the building. I wanted to start addressing issues of the public realm and started to start some initiatives around me and help my community in different ways, starting a farmer's market. I started this group called the Raleigh Urban Rangers, where we go around and activate public spaces that are neglected. And I started to realize more and more that there is life here. You know, when I started that farmer's market, it was like I was walking by this empty parking lot every day, kind of growling, thinking something better should be happening here. This is a wound in the urban fabric. And I thought about a farmer's market. Other people started talking about it. And I got some pushback. Oh, no one will ever go there. It's too hot. It belongs to the state. They won't allow it. I called them up, and that's always the hardest part, is the first step, you know. Called them up, and they said, we don't care. We don't use it on the weekends. And so, yeah, you can do that. And I was like, oh, you're kidding. And so I got the permit free of charge and then started just talking to farmers and saying, who would like to come downtown? And was very nervous, like, this might be ridiculous. The day of the first market it was like over 100 degrees.
Wow.
But it transformed. I mean, I was just like blown away. You know, all the neighbors came. It was at this sort of intersection of all the neighborhoods. Mm. We had hammocks, we had a band, we had break dancing and kids in hammocks and all this food. And people were, I mean, in a place that was so dead, to see that transformation, to be full of life. So that really kind of was a bug that bit me hard. It's like, this is amazing that this, I could help instigate this.
Yeah.
It gave me confidence, you know, that this can happen in other places. Other people can do this. And also that life is there hidden and it's just waiting to be invited out. You just have to invite and give people permission. And they're waiting for that.
But who's responsible to bring the life out?
What'd you say? Who's responsible?
Yeah. Like, is it the city and the land owners, the people?
I mean, I think we all should do our part, you know, but I think the city does need to let people know that they can come out, that they can do certain things. I think what happens is there's always this feeling among the community that they aren't supposed to do things, or that it's not legal, or they need a permit and that kind of thing. And so that was one reason for starting this Placemaking Raleigh initiative, which is really about trying to grease the runway for that kind of thing to happen, you know, to say, to make a website, because if you go to the website of the city, it's sort of official and not that friendly generally. So I wanted to make a website, which is sort of in construction now, of showing how you can do these pop-ups, or if you want to have a play street, or if you want to have a block party or something, and spelling out the process to do that, and what permits you need, and then also showcasing examples of other things that have happened in our city or other things that have happened around the country, and celebrating those and giving ideas on what you could do. So to try to bridge that gap between the top and the bottom. And I think that's really what a lot of people are working on now. And I hear that on your podcast too. A lot of people talking about trying to bridge that gap between the top and the bottom. I like to think of it sort of like desire lines. Do you know what desire lines are?
No, tell me.
It's like those paths that people make in a park or in a grass area. It's the way they want to walk.
The user. Yeah.
Instead of the walking along the path that's laid out for them, or the hard walkway, the sidewalk. It's like, no, I want to go this way. And so it's that kind of bottom up creation of a path. And I think that that's what we do as placemakers. It's like to strengthen those desire lines, you know, to like, this is the way we want to move, and make those more official themselves, you know. So I went on the road trip with Ryan Smolar in Placemaking US, and I was really excited to see all of the initiatives across the country, people doing that, you know, so starting their own nonprofits, trying to bridge between the community and the government. And so that's the kind of impetus behind Placemaking Raleigh, is trying to suggest to people that this is okay, and that we encourage it, and let's make it easy. And so it's funded by the AIA and partly by the BID downtown. And it's the idea that, you know, neighborhoods can entertain themselves, that we don't have to bring in a band or go buy a ticket or something, that there's a lot of talent.
Yeah, we got talent, yeah.
We got talent and we got life, and let's just invite it out. And so just trying to make it easy and fun and accessible. And that's very much needed here. You know, I think generally you have it better in Europe from my perspective.
Depends, yeah. But like, what is like your biggest challenges as a placemaker in order to do something outdoor? Is it like getting the permission from the city?
I think it's part of it is, yes. Well, one is like figuring out what the rules are. Can we have food? You know, are we going to get in trouble? You know, what's allowed? And that's not always clear from the city, and it's kind of a moving target. They're trying to sort of get looser and be more fun. And I'm glad to see that with this Placemaking Raleigh, that they've sort of responded and they've started helping out, sort of mimicking it, you know, because before we didn't used to be able to have barricades. It was that in order for you to have a block party or close off the street, you had to get your own barricades. The city wouldn't provide them. And those are really expensive, like to rent. So I went out and bought them. And they're in a storage shed. We have like a placemaking kit here in a shed by a neighbor, and anyone can go in there and use these things. Close off the street, no problem. I have a truck, I'll bring it. And but now the city now went out and bought barricades. So that's good. So it's like, you know, it's that kind of push and pull. And, you know, I think that's really critical. So yeah, the figuring out the rules, and then I think connecting with the community and the neighbors, I think, is another sort of challenge. It's like, you know, how you reach out to communities and get them sort of on the bandwagon, get them
like activate
exactly. And sometimes you have to show them how to do it somewhere else, and then they'll say, "Ooh, I want to do that." You know, that's happened to me before, done something, and then they're like, "Whoa, that's cool. We want that too." And I think one challenge for me is you know, we're trying to reach some marginalized communities, not just the wealthier ones. And so knowing, finding the people embedded in that neighborhood or the neighborhood leaders and instigators there, and connecting with them and seeing what they want to do is a challenge. And so that takes time. I think those kinds of relationships to reach out beyond the immediate sphere of the people that you know. And that's harder because it's like, oh, what if nobody comes?
And, yeah.
You know,
do you also like trying to make it economical, sustainable somehow, like the placemaking rally?
So or right now it's being funded by grants. So okay. It's like the bid is given funding for it, and the AIA has given funding for it, the NCAIA. So at the moment it's grant funded. And I have to say that that's always been a challenge for me just as an architect. Also is like how you make this kind of work, sustainable in terms of funding and finances, I think it's a huge challenge, and I don't think it's actually addressed enough.
It's because like nobody believes in this kind of projects or initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, again, America is very kind of, I don't know, it's profit driven, and it's not, there's less money generally put into social infrastructure and shared things. And I it's too bad, but too often I think architecture ends up serving the rich. Kind of the elite, because they can afford it. And that's always bothered me. So carving that new path is a difficult one. And there's all kinds of people who trying to do that as well. But, it can be nonprofits or getting grant funding or working for the government. But it's a difficult road in terms of the finances, I believe, for ordinary people, ordinary architects, because I think what's a shame is that there's all kinds of people in the profession who would love to do this kind of work, especially young people coming up. Young people are so motivated by, community service and placement, all these things. And yet the career paths aren't really clear to them on what they can do. You must see that at where you are, because you teach.
It's not easy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this takes us to the next question, is like, what should architects stop doing when they design?
Well, architects, I think, like planners.
You can, like, it's about urban practitioners. We're talking about city development. So what should we stop doing?
What should we stop doing is, I think, generally, they should stop trying to design everything. I think they need to leave space for kind of soft inhabitations, like I was saying earlier. It's like, they need to stop trying to predict everything and wrap it all up in a tidy bow, and so be the ones to make all the decisions, to recognize that, the environment is really a series of layers, and to leave space for people to come in and change it. And I think that's hard for architects to accept, is like to design for change. So I think it's really valuable to evaluate the work you do according to time, sort of what's the life of your project, how might it change over a day, over a year, throughout the seasons? What's it going to be like in 20 years as well? But like, how can it be agile and change use? And we're already seeing that downtowns with COVID, the loss of office workers. So it's like that idea of designing for change is kind of rubs against architects, because they want it all to be perfect and be ready for the photograph.
Yeah.
and they don't want that messy life in there, and they don't want people messing around with what they decided. And I think that, urban planners could probably be the same way, but I think we have to accept that change is part of any kind of living organism, which is what cities and buildings are. In order for them to be inhabited, and I think also we need to start paying attention to what is in a place, what's there, you know, listening more, noticing what's there, noticing the life that's in a place before rushing in and changing things or making our mark, you know, to take pause, you know, to take some time and observe and see what you can amplify instead of, you know, and reinforce the good, the life in a place. So, I think that kind of humility is really good. And, you know, just realizing that life animates our spaces, and that the way we should evaluate our buildings and what we do, our built environment, is like how it supports life. And the dynamism of it, how it can change. I when I was in Japan, they have a very poetic way of looking at buildings, and one is they look at the soft part of the environment, which is critical. You know, and it's, there was a ledge on a house, and I was asking my employer, my boss, like, what is that for? And she said, that's where the moonlight sits.
What?
And so just this idea that there's,
yeah,
there's all this softness, these transitory, yeah, things in the environment, and we should celebrate them.
Yeah.
We should invite them in. I just came back from Venice, where I saw Scarpa's work, Carlo Scarpa, and he makes places for water to come in, and it transforms and it goes out. So I think nature and people, these soft, dynamic, transitory things need to be made room for and celebrated and designed for change. And I don't think we think about that enough.
Tina, in order to have this mindset, what kind of skills do we need to develop as architects?
I think we need to think about looking at how things can be inhabited. And again, sort of like looking at as a habitat, like a coral reef, how can something come in and inhabit this environment I've made in different ways? Like, even when I was designing houses, I would test the strength of the design by the capacity of the floor plan. Like, how can the living room be where the dining room is? Or what if, you know, grandma moves in, or what if the kids come back, or how can it change over time? How am I allowing for growth from the bottom up? You know, and then you can decide on a floor plan or a design that has the most capacity, that allows the most options for people, and to give people those options. And to practice doing that, sort of testing out scenarios. You know what, and I think we have to get better at that as we evolve, you know, and as we head towards climate change and all the change that's coming at us, to realize that you aren't going to come up with the one answer to this place, this problem, but that you are setting up a prompt that others will respond to and take over. And that also relates back to this idea of making places versus objects. You know, there's some places like Levittown, which is sort of like a suburban development in the US, that were seen as objects, but they grew over time. So if you look at how a house can be added on to over time, and that's how you place maybe where the core is or the bathroom, and you don't, you know, block things from the outside, you know, you make them in the center, things like that, where you really start thinking about how it might be added on to. Mm. You're not going to have your precious object. It's going to pass. Everything is passing. Yeah, it'll all be dead. Yeah, it'll all change. Yeah. And so how is it going to grow and accept that? And how can you facilitate that growth? I think those kinds of exercises are really needed today by planners and architects.
Yeah. Do you think that we have all the knowledge and tools in order to create livable places and child-friendly places? I mean, what is stopping us from doing it?
I think we need to be needs to be demanded of us. You know, I mean, I think that as professionals, you know, we need pushback from the government and from people to say, this is what we want. You know, this is what we need. And I think the education system, I mean, I do believe that all of this is evolving and changing. And I am encouraged that young people are kind of moving into positions of power and valuing things that we haven't traditionally, that the profession is evolving. I think we, as you know, traditionally, a lot of these professions have been very siloed. So once you start getting other perspectives, and you involve landscape architects and developers, who are really key, and you start having conversations, sharing knowledge, sharing stories, sharing language, that will lead to some of these solutions. You know, I think what's we've suffered from, I know in the architecture profession, is just being too separate and just patting ourselves on the back, giving each other awards, having our own little magazines, and we need to be shaken up, you know. And I think that's one reason the placemaking world kind of was so invigorating for me, especially during COVID, is it like all these sort of cross-cutting conversations, cutting across disciplines. I got very excited, and I didn't hear those kinds of conversations going on in my profession. And I think people have, you know, they're protecting their own territory and all that. So if we can start mixing it up a little bit, having more conversations, having more podcasts like this one, where we can share knowledge laterally, you know, and you're very good about, you know, interviewing people top and bottom, famous, not famous. You know, I mean, I love it. So thank you for this.
No, thank you so much. It's
I think it's really important.
Like if you imagine the future, like 100 years from now,
mm-hmm.
how do you see it? Like, how do you see our cities? Like more from like now, focus on the child-friendly cities. Do you see like our future cities going to be a child-friendly cities or not 100 years from now?
Well, I hope so. I think, I mean, literally, if 100 years from now, I think we'll be struggling with climate change and all kinds of issues. But, you know, we'll be struggling for resources and all that. But I think that if you design for children, you're also designing for climate change, honestly. If you do one, you get the other. So it's like Tim Gill says, if you put a child-friendly lens on, it forces people to think long-term. You know, you're thinking in terms of your children, what kind of world they'll have, and it breaks down barriers. And so when we make our cities more green, more nature friendly, you know, more walkable, more bikeable, more local, that all of that is child friendly, and it coincides completely with a more climate friendly, sustainable city, resilient city. So I think it's hopefully going to be very child friendly, if we survive. You know, hopefully we will.
Yes.
But I think that thinking about children is really going to help us move towards climate friendly solutions, and it's a good way to bring people together over these issues instead of just thinking about, you know, how close is my car to my front door, things like that.
Yeah. No, interesting answers there. And now let's move to the next section of this episode, and it's more about you and your relation to the city. And so the first question is about, like, what makes you sad in your city?
What makes me sad is that there isn't more mobility options, non-car mobility options. You know, we don't have as strong a bike infrastructure and walkable. It's not walkable. That it isn't as child friendly. That there is a lot of fear still. A lot of no signs. Don't do this. Don't do that. Instead of yes, come do this. You know. There's a lack of affordable housing. There's a lack of small scale development. I think that we, like a lot of cities, Raleigh is really growing and one of the fastest growing cities in the country, honestly. And we have, you know, developers are attracted to that, out of town developers. So there's a lot of building that's big, and they'll assemble parcels all together and do a big development instead of enabling more incremental local development, local business. So that kind of small scale diversity we're losing. We're also losing a lot of our character and historic buildings. That's not being valued or incorporated because it's easier to just wipe it all out. And I think that we're missing a lot of casual places to gather and connect with each other, you know, just meet neighbors. And which is one reason I started this Placemaking Raleigh thing. Just sort of, let's just take it to the streets. Let's take over our streets, because we don't have enough places like that to go. And I think nature, you know, is suffering as well here. They're not incorporating nature as much as they should. Losing some trees. But the car, you know, the car is big, as we all know, huge, huge. And we're so addicted to it, and it's hard for people to imagine a future without it, but we have to.
And what makes you happy?
What makes me happy is that things are changing slowly. And we have started some bike lanes. They're emerging. There is some pushback coming. I think communities are organizing because they're not feeling heard. I think, you know, what made me sad too is just that there's so much top-down kind of decision-making and not enough community engagement. So people are reacting to that. There's a lot more spilling out. I think that COVID opened the door to that, like in a lot of places, you know, that we have to go outside, and a lot of that is staying, and that's a huge benefit. It's great to see life out on the street. And I live in a very walkable sort of downtown neighborhood, so I'm really grateful for that. And, you know, other things that make me happy are like the people I know here, especially the weirdos, the characters, the people that make it different.
Yeah, yeah.
Offer unique things. I think it is good.
Yeah. And if you will get $1 million and you can invest it in a project related to city development, in what kind of project will you invest it?
Bike lanes. I mean, I just think it's transformative. If we can, but we have to build it first. I think protected bike lanes, if we can start moving around on bikes instead of cars, just making that one shift, would be huge, huge. And we have a sort of a dense downtown and neighborhoods right close to it to where it would work. So I really think that would make the biggest difference. Get out of your car. It's what we all need to learn. And in the US, so many towns are, you know, designed around it. So that shift's basic, really critical, I think.
Bike lanes, huh?
Yeah, that's how I would totally invest $1 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Just build it. And then, you know, just getting people to move around. You know, see their city differently. See it differently. It's a great pace, the bike, you know, and it's easier sometimes than walking. You know, just I love the in-between space of the bike, you know, where, because I get tired sometimes walking and it's hot, but the bike makes a breeze. You can stop and you can adjust your pace, and you see the city differently, and it's for all kinds of income levels and ages. So I just think that would be an enormous benefit to the city, is to have a robust bike infrastructure. And then just see how people respond. You know, it's like, it's always this chicken and the egg, you know, they're afraid to invest in it. No one will use it.
Yeah. That, yeah.
Those kinds of fears.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it'd be great to have dollars.
Yeah. And Tina, name something you're really proud of.
I was really proud of the farmer's market that I popped up. You know, that, I mean, the courage it took to take that, to take that step and make it happen. It taught me something. And I'm also proud of of I had I really grew a very successful architecture profession with a great reputation and doing work I'm proud of. And I could easily keep going down that road. So, but it took a lot of courage for me to start saying no to some of that work so that I could give myself space to address some of these bigger issues and try to, you know, contribute to my community in whatever way I can, and to open up the door to working with all kinds of people. And that's been very rewarding. So I think every time someone calls me for the project and I say no, I have to pat myself on the back for that, you know, instead of, and now I intentionally choose and go after what I think is important.
Yeah. So what do you think is important now for you? What kind of projects?
Well, I really want to develop this Placemaking Raleigh initiative. I would also like to grow the placemaking kind of movement and network here in my own state and in the Southeast. I think the Southeast is generally kind of neglected, you know, because everybody thinks New York and LA and all these other cities, the Northeast is where it's happening. But there's all kinds of growth here and need here in the Southeast. So I'd really like to connect them, the people here with more progressive ideas and the idea of placemaking. I want to really stay connected to the global community of placemakers and urbanists and bring those ideas here. At the same time, grow what's here. You know, have you heard of that Gertrude Stein quote about the there?
No.
Like she says, there's no there, meaning like just Nowheresville. And so I really want to excavate the there. So to say what's unique about this place, how can we celebrate it and sort of be a model for other places? And part of that, yes, tapping into the energy of children and making it child friendly. And I mean, that's always going to be in my heart, you know, as a mother and but older people as well. There's so many populations that are neglected and segregated, and also nature that's being obliterated. So I think making people aware of what kind of place they have and how the hidden gems there, the nature that's there, and restoring that and celebrating it, being aware of like the rivers that go through your town. Let's unearth those. I mean, for me, that's another, it would be a wonderful project that would be great for nature and for kids, is like daylighting some of these urban streams. And then also it connects the people of Raleigh, of this place, with the ocean, or how they're connected to the whole network of water. So how places are formed naturally, I think, to become more aware of where you are on earth in this particular place and to celebrate it. I think if I can help push that forward and help, you know, again, strengthen these desire lines between the top and the bottom here and strengthen the social infrastructure, you know, I would be very happy if I could just get more activations percolating throughout the neighborhoods and sort of foster this culture of bottom-up placemaking throughout our city, I would be thrilled.
Honestly, Tina, do you feel like social isolated where you live in the U.S. now?
I mean, I don't personally right now feel it so much. I mean, I've been in this neighborhood for almost 30 years. And so, but I've seen the isolation in others. I've seen like my parents become isolated when they grew older. I see other people suffering from isolation, you know, my brothers and have, and I saw my kids, you know, struggling to connect with other kids. And, it's very destructive, you know. I think, and you know, I have groups of women and other people I meet with, but you have to make a real effort. And I feel like it should be easier. And I think it becomes harder as you get older or if you're very young sometimes, you know, and that can have a real impact on you. So if people can move around more easily and meet in places more casually, have more plazas where everyone is welcome. But the way we've developed, the way we've sprawled and built communities separate and dependent on the car has added to that. And I think also a kind of attitude of like, okay, you get old, we put you there. You're young, we put you there. And I think that kind of shift is, it needs to be made. There's a group here in my neighborhood that is starting an initiative of aging in place. And so they're trying to stay in their houses, and they're following a model of trying to create a database of people that can support them as they age and share resources like handymen or medical personnel or people that can do a grocery shopping and that kind of thing. So they're feeling more secure about staying where they are, which I think is ideal, rather than going off to a center. You know, so the more we can stay integrated with each other and see each other. I mean, it's healthy to see kids. It's healthy to see old people. It's part of life. We were all there. It's where we're headed. We have to like kind of deal with it and appreciate it. And we can contribute to each other's, you know, richness of living. It's not all, you know, homogenous. So,
yeah. And a next question is about something you regret doing in your career, something maybe you did before.
I would just say that I wish I had jumped into the world of the public realm earlier, and sort of community activism and trying to shift towards public service earlier. I think I enjoyed what I did, but I feel like I spent probably too much time designing single family homes early on, even though it taught me about people and housing and all kinds of things. But the energy I've gotten from thinking about bigger issues and placemaking and stuff just shows me that I wish I'd shifted a little bit earlier in my career and maybe, yeah, I got more involved in landscape and urban design and other things like that, bigger picture things, issues, helping the public.
Yeah. Interesting conversation, Tina. And now we are heading to the last section of this episode, and it's about you giving messages. So the first question is about you giving a message to yourself.
I would say to follow your inner compass. I should follow my inner compass and take where my energy leads me. You know, notice where what gives me energy and follow that, and not necessarily go down the paths that you think are expected of you or the conventional roles, but to be brave to carve your own path. And follow what turns you on, and always referring back to that. I think that's important, because we get caught up so much in what we think we're supposed to do, what's expected of us, what the conventional roles are, what's on the menu. Maybe what we want isn't really on the menu, or maybe it's a mix up of a bunch of different things on the menu.
Interesting. And three takeaway messages to the listener.
Okay. One, I'm going to read these few lines from John Habrocken. It's a poem that I have taped on my wall. And it's just that no one builds alone. When you do something large, leave the small to others. When you do something small, enhance the large.
Wow.
So I think that's very wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's we need all these layers, all the scales. The second I would say is that we're all placemakers. You know that song, birds do it, bees do it, even educated, please do it. Have you heard of that song? No? No. Anyway, but everyone's a placemaker. When you set a table, when you have a picnic, when you grow a garden, you throw a party, you furnish your home. We're all making places all the time, whether we're aware of it or not. So to find and fully express the inner placemaker in you, the amount of joy, I think, community connection that will come from that. So in whatever way you can, to exercise your power of inhabitation in your community and everywhere else, express yourself. And lastly, I would say notice more. You know, notice first. You know, notice the there. Notice the dynamic life that's already in a place, and honor it and make space for it and embrace it, grow it, celebrate it. Give yourself the space to appreciate what is before rushing in and making your mark. I just feel like there's a lot more of listening, like what you do, and documenting and paying attention to the life in a place. And I think all of these things have their analogy in the natural world as well. Or you wipe something out, take a survey of what's living, what's there. So
Tina, what do you want people to read about you when they gonna Google your name in 100 years from now?
Okay. Well, I don't think that I will come up in 100 years, but...
If they will type your name, what do you want people to say about you or to read about you?
Okay. I think that I helped strengthen the social infrastructure of where I lived and facilitated this bottom-up placemaking and engagement, empowering people to express themselves and helping connect the top and the bottom and to see their place in a new way. And to honor the life of a place, I think if that came up, I'd be thrilled. If I can just help the people who are here express themselves and communicate and make their own place. That everyone wants to connect with the place. It's like any relationship; you want to love your place. So, allowing people to do that and express it—that's
so beautiful. And the last question is going to be you asking it to us. So what is your question to me and to the listener?
What is one small step you can take to address what you feel is missing from where you live? To improve your place or bring attention to something that's overlooked, maybe a hidden life or beauty or talent? Are there hidden gems in your place? What is the there? How can you nurture it? How can you cultivate the garden around you? To officials and professions, how can you trust and enable the people to live in a place to take that step? How can you enable the small-scale interventions and inhabitations of residents? Allow that to blossom and express itself.
Yeah. Wow. I need like... You should send me the text of the questions and the takeaway messages, like the poetry that you read.
Okay.
It's really beautiful. So email me later, so I put it on the
episode
description. Yeah. But Tina, I'm very, very happy and inspired by our conversation. So thank you so much for giving your valuable time to do this.
Thank you, Mustafa. And thank you for all that you do. You're really... weaving together the mycelium, the roots of this whole movement, and helping us all grow stronger.
Yes, we do this together. So thank you so much. And we, keep up the good work and keep loving cities.
Thanks. See you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I hope you really enjoyed this episode. you learned something new and also got inspired by the guest. Don't forget to share the episode on your social media and recommend it to people you think they are really interested in this topic. Thank you so much again for giving your valuable time to Urbanistica Podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif. Keep up the good work. Keep loving cities.